From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. American and British diplomats and families are flying out of the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, as Russian troops are not far away on the Ukrainian border. The U.S. is also sending more military aid to Ukraine as NATO bolsters its eastern front. Let's get the latest from Kyiv now, where we find Washington Post foreign correspondent Isabel Kershudian. Hi, Isabel.
Hi.
Now, you're the Moscow correspondent, but currently in Ukraine. Does it feel like Ukrainians are steeling themselves for war? What's the atmosphere?
You know, I was here last month, and at that point, I would have said that, you know, a lot of Ukrainians were pretty skeptical that a war was coming or an invasion was imminent. Now, I think the mood has shifted a little bit. You still have the skeptics. You still have people who, you know, aren't panic buying, you know, water and non-perishable goods or anything like that. But then you have people who have started to talk about, well, if we were to have to evacuate, what would we do? Where would we go? Should we have a bag ready? I think those conversations are happening more and more, and you're starting to see people, you know, kind of get a little bit more nervous. But at the same time, you know, even Ukraine's president last week when Secretary of State Antony Blinken was here, Volodymyr Zelensky, the president, gave an address on, you know, national television saying, don't panic, Ukrainians. We've been dealing with this for 8 years. And it was the same day Blinken said an attack could happen at any time. So I do think there's a little bit of a mix of emotions.
Yeah, well, I guess speaking of kind of messaging and the reality on the ground, the Ukrainian government does not seem very happy about the withdrawal of some diplomats. The government says the move is a premature one and an instance of excessive caution. What more have you learned from officials in Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something where officials here are worried that, you know, because Ukrainian citizens see diplomats leaving, you know, the Australian embassy is following suit. People are going to start really panicking. And I think, you know, that's what the Ukrainian government wants to avoid. And you see Europe taking a very different approach where, you know, France and Germany aren't doing that yet. And I think, you know, it's partially kind of the range of, you know, the U.S. and the U.K. especially have been a little bit more concerned and more vocal in saying that this is a very serious threat, that an invasion, you know, could be imminent. Whereas Europe has kind of taken a more cautious approach with all of that. And even the Ukrainians have been, you know, ones to kind of talk down the threat sometimes and say, you know, Russia could be bluffing. So I think that's how you're seeing everyone kind of react to this news. These are the positions they've had all along through this.
Mm-hmm. And how are people in Kyiv reacting to what President Biden is saying? As you know, last week he had to backpedal after saying he thinks that Putin will move in and suggested a minor incursion into Ukraine might be tolerated.
Yeah, well, officials in Ukraine were obviously not happy with that remark. And it went totally against, you know, kind of all of this messaging that the U.S. had, you know, really been pushing until that point, which was, it's going to be severe economic consequences, really, you know, unprecedented sanctions, so on and so forth. So I think everything since then, you know, since the minor incursion gaffe, if you will, has been more positive because, you know, there's been a lot of publicity around this military aid that's coming. You know, the Ukrainians are even holding a press conference for when all of the new weaponry arrives tomorrow morning. So, you know, I think from the Ukrainians' perspective, they didn't like that remark. It sent a pretty bad message in their minds to Russia. But the U.S. is still their biggest partner in all of this, so they can't be too upset.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the weekend, British intelligence said the Russians are plotting to install a pro-Russia leader in Ukraine. What has the Ukrainian reaction been to that?
So the guy who's mentioned as, like, the potential candidate to be pro-Russian leader, Muraev, he's not seen as a very influential or popular figure here. So at first it was a lot of skepticism, I would say, and you know, maybe that the intelligence was premature or that it just didn't really seem plausible if that's what Russia was really planning. However, you know, from the British point of view, it's that they want to kind of preempt any Russian attempts to say, oh, this was, you know, a revolution and, you know, people put this guy in themselves and we didn't get involved. Because we know that Russia has kind of done things, you know, through back corners like that before, particularly with, you know, the separatist conflicts in the Donbas region in Ukraine's east. So I think, you know, this is the UK trying to say, no, when you try to do this, we're going to be like, we said this was coming. But I would say people here kind of took it with a grain of salt, too.
Isabel Kershudian of The Washington Post. Thanks again.
Thank you.
For nearly 8 years, Ukrainians have learned to live with a war against Russian-backed separatists on their country's eastern border. But with tensions rising now as Russian troops gather on the border, a strike against Ukraine seems more imminent. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley spent a recent evening with a family in the capital, Kyiv, where she found them preparing for the worst.
Artem and Marina Klyuchnikovs eat dinner with their two youngest children at the kitchen table. They've raised all four of their kids, ages 22, 18, 11, and 3, in this small apartment in a Soviet-era housing block on the outskirts of Kyiv. But with the threat of a Russian invasion, they wonder if they might soon have to leave, says Artem.
We do not have like a suitcase with stuff already packed into it, but I have a checklist so that I will just, you know, if something happens. And I need to make sure that my car has at least three quarters of a tank full at any given point in time.
Over the last 8 years, Artem and Marina, both 46, have seen changes in their country brought on by the frozen conflict in the east. They say Ukrainians have started to see their neighbor as an enemy.
We see the lies that Russia tells about us. We see the numbers, the death toll of people in the east. You know, how many soldiers die for us. I think it goes to the, I don't know, national memory, I guess, where we know what is the reason for those deaths.
It's Russian President Vladimir Putin. They hold him responsible for the more than 13,000 dead. Putin also took the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine in 2014. But Artem says Putin is getting the opposite of what he wants.
Putin has done a lot of good thing for establishing Ukrainian national mentality. He's the one who invested so much effort into that. He tried to bring us in, but the only thing that he has done is pushed us away.
Polls show a majority of Ukrainians now want to be a part of NATO, which was not the case before.
And it's funny, you know, when I was growing up in Soviet Union, I still remember how NATO was portrayed then. That it's a threat, that it's an enemy, that all they want is to invade, etc., etc.
Artem says Putin's rhetoric hasn't changed since Soviet times. He and Marina say most Ukrainians don't want to speak Russian anymore, and there's a resurgence of the Ukrainian language and culture since 2014.
It's a painful issue for me because my father, for instance, he grew up in Russia. My great-grandmother, she was a teacher of Russian, and I grew up speaking Russian, and I was never against Russia. Never.
But now Marina doesn't even speak Russian with her own sister anymore. Eldest son Nikita drops by. He's studying at Kyiv's National University of Construction and Architecture. He says his crowd isn't thinking much about war and politics.
You know, we're not concerned till it's getting to you personally. For instance, like right now, one of my main concerns actually is not going to the military.
Like Nikita, many young Ukrainians NPR talked to aren't following the situation as closely as their elders. As parents, Marina and Artem have to deal with the threat of a Russian invasion on top of the pandemic. They've also had health concerns. 3-year-old Sasha had to have open-heart surgery a year and a half ago. Marina says he was strapped to a hospital bed for 10 days.
I couldn't hug him, couldn't hold him.
So she sang to him in Ukrainian. She runs and gets her guitar as we're speaking. Marina believes God gives children two parents for a reason. She lets Artem follow the war and daily tensions with Russia.
It's important for your children that the mom is happy, that mom is stable emotionally. There are people around us, and somehow, with God's help, we do believe we're going to manage it.
The Klyuchnikovs say if Russia invades, their plan is to get out of the city and take refuge at the family cottage in a village a few hours west of Kiev. There's no running water or electricity, but they'll be able to grow their own food, they say. They've begun drying fruits and vegetables to take with them. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kiev.
One of the most acclaimed documentaries of last year is now on the short list for an Oscar nomination. Summer of Soul, set in the summer of 1969, as American cities were still reeling from the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and the escalating war in Vietnam. Music provided a haven. Of course, there was Woodstock, which helped define the era. But for many Black Americans, the place to go was the Harlem Cultural Festival. Some 300,000 people attended the 6 concerts, where a dizzying array of jazz, blues, gospel, and pop greats took the stage. Here's a sample.
This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. Age of Aquarius. You would say, what pretty little girl can make a man like me feel so sweet? It's my girl. Don't you wonder how I do?
Gladys Knight and the Pips, before that, David Ruffin, just out of the Temptations, and of course, The Fifth Dimension, with one of the biggest hits of the year. The Harlem Cultural Festival was filmed for broadcast, but most of the footage sat in a basement for 5 decades until it was culled and turned into The Summer of Soul, directed by Questlove of the Roots. The film is available on Hulu, and the soundtrack drops this coming Friday. So we wanted to revisit a conversation Robin Young had last June with Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., husband and wife and founding members of The Fifth Dimension.
Marilyn McCoo, are you there?
Yes, I am, Robin.
Welcome. And Billy Davis Jr., welcome to you as well.
Well, thank you, Robin.
We can see on screen, we're watching you watch this film. What was it like to see this? Billy, you start.
Well, to see ourselves performing in front of all of this magnificent crowd of people, and especially all these Black people, it was just amazing. It was electrifying because it was truly some beautiful footage that had been tucked away.
Oh, and the performances are amazing. And Marilyn McCoo, we watch you hand to your mouth.
I don't remember doing that. What I was remembering was seeing the audience, seeing the families, seeing the excitement on their faces, and remembering how I felt backstage before we went on, excitement about performing for these people who had, most of whom had probably never seen us before live. Of course, they were going to hear Up, Up and Away, which had been a huge hit. And then they were going to hear Aquarius, Let the Sunshine In. And then we picked a couple of songs that they probably had not heard from us. That was a different sound from what they had heard of the pop hits that we had had. So I was excited and I was nervous. I was wondering how they were going to receive us.
Well, let's talk a little more about that. I mean, every performer, even if they're Marilyn McCoo and it's Fifth Dimension, and as we see in the film, you're adored. They somehow found a young person who had gone to the festival now 5 decades later, who was there because he was so in love with you, as many in the country were. But you said something I didn't know. You said that sometimes you were criticized for, quote, sounding white. And
yes,
it sounds like that was behind some of your thinking coming out, you know, on that stage. Talk more about that.
Well, it wasn't me being nervous about them seeing me. It was being nervous about them seeing us and how they were going to receive us. When the Fifth Dimension started out, the songs that we recorded that made hits for us were pop songs. And there was a great deal of racial division in the way that many of the radio stations pick their music. They had pop stations and then they had R&B stations. Some of the pop stations played our music because they thought we were white. Mm-hmm. And then when they found out we were Black, they weren't so anxious to play our music. But by that time, our records were hits and they wanted to play hits. So they played our music. And then there were R&B stations that we were hoping would play our music. But the R&B stations, we weren't singing R&B, we were singing pop. So they said we didn't fit their format. So then they're saying, but they're Black artists, you know, and they said their music doesn't fit our format.
It doesn't make any difference. You know, but during those times, you know, artists was always trying to get both stations to play their music because they were always trying to cross over. And even like a lot of your Motown artists couldn't cross over to pop. That didn't happen until later.
Let me add one more thing to that, too. The group was doing a number of concerts in colleges. Sometimes the Black students would protest because they'd say, you said you were going to bring in some artists that appealed to us, and then you bring in the Fifth Dimension, and all they do is that pop music. They appeal to the white students. We want music that appeals to the Black students. And we felt like, why don't they even give us a chance? You know, so it was a little hurtful at that time.
But, you know, the ones that did come to the concert, when they left, they were totally satisfied. Yeah. It was an awakening for them. So they would go tell the other students, but that, you know.
And they'd write comments in the editorial column saying you guys should have come and see what they do instead of just judging them based on the hit song that they had.
Well, in the film, we see you again watching today what happened back then, crying. You say, we just wanted our people to accept us. And boy, that audience in Harlem sure did. You know, it feels like in the film, there are a lot of people talking about trying to make their way in this time of such profound shift. There's a vocalist from Edwin Hawkins Singer's Oh Happy Day. This whole chorus comes on stage and sings this gospel song that was a huge hit at the time.
Oh, happy day. Oh, happy day. In Jesus alone.
I didn't know that the chorus was ostracized by the Christian church, who felt that it was outside the boundaries of this fundamentalist church. You weren't even allowed to dance. She said, we were ostracized, but we felt that people needed Oh Happy Day.
Well, we need a whole lot of more Oh Happy Days. You know, right now we can use them, because if we don't, we're going to lose our democracy. And that's going to be a terrible thing to see a country as great as the United States for something like that to happen.
Well, and we want to talk about the salve that you're hoping to put on that wound right now. But I just, again, we also hear the Reverend Jesse Jackson instruct the audience, say it loud, I'm Black and proud. We have Nina Simone come on the stage, same stage you were on, tells the audience she's going to play something, and it turned out to be the song she wrote for her friend Lorraine Hansberry, Young, Gifted, and Black, and she hits the word Black like a hammer. Here's one of her later recorded versions.
Young, gifted, and black.
Oh, what a lovely, precious dream.
To be young, gifted, and black.
Open your heart to
what... Well, I thought it was great. She was being true Nina Simone. Her protest songs was always about what was happening in the world at that particular time. And she let it be known, you know, and she was proud of her people and proud to be Black, and she would put it out there.
Yeah. I want to make sure I've asked about your new album. It's called Blackbird. It's a cover of Beatles tunes, including that one. Did you know, Marilyn McCoo, that Blackbird was written by Paul McCartney and John Lennon, but largely Paul, after he was inspired reading about the Little Rock Nine in Arkansas, who had integrated a school, and of course, the riots that ensued. He actually, a couple years ago, met two of the Little Rock Nine when he was touring, and The word Blackbird, it's about the women of the civil rights movement.
As a matter of fact, I did know that. And I'm surprised that you know that, because there are so few people who do know real story about how that song came together and who he wrote it in tribute to, which was all the more reason why we felt that it was a perfect song for the project. And Billy singing Ticket to Ride, we looked at it as kind of like a tribute to Rosa Parks and her decision not to get up out of her seat. It was like, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired.
And I'm not giving up my
and
seat.
I'm not giving up my seat.
Yeah, baby, she's got a ticket to ride. And she's got a ticket to ride. Oh, yes, she has. She's got a ticket to ride. Yeah, she don't care.
Those were a couple of the points that were being made. And we were just reaching out and saying, come on, you all. We need to get through this. We need to start caring about one another. We need to start loving one another. All of us are alike. We're not so different.
Yeah. We're kind of hoping that this project, Blackbird, Lennon McCartney Icons, will bring some healing to the nation and to the world, really, and that it will kind of help close the divide.
And add to that an incredible history lesson in the new documentary that you're featured in, Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. But it's a history lesson with great music and afros and energy. And,
yes. All of those elements of that period.
Right.
Yeah. Fifth Dimension founding members Billy Davis Jr. and Maurin McCoo, thank you so much.
Well, it's our
thank
pleasure
you,
to
Robert.
Talk to
thank you.
Our interview was recorded last June.
Tax filing season officially opens today. This as the IRS is already dealing with a backlog of millions of returns because of staff shortages. Here with some tips to get through a third season of taxes in this pandemic is our friend Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Okay, Jill, let's get to it. For families that received child tax credit money in 2021, what should they keep in mind when they file?
Well, first of all, I know a lot of people are confused about this, and you are not alone. So here's the biggest aspect of this that you need to take into account. First of all, a number of you got the child tax credit in 6 installments last year, but that was only half of the money. To get the other half of the money, to claim that, you actually have to file this on your tax return. Now, the IRS has sent out letter 6419. Actually, they did it through the snail mail, so you got to check that out. But if you want, go to irs.gov, the Child Tax Care Update Portal, and you may even find that if you didn't get any advance payments last year, you may get a lump sum by claiming the child tax credit when you file this year. So that's your child tax credit boot camp right there.
Yeah, okay. Complicated. Keep that all in mind. What about those who got stimulus payments, aka economic impact payments?
Well, those aren't taxable, so that's great. But if you didn't receive a payment, you have to file for what's called the recovery rebate credit on your tax return. Good old line 30 on form 1040. Mm. You'll also probably get a separate letter from the IRS about that as well. So just, you know, keep an eye on that. But again, very important that, you know, honestly, economic stimulus dollars, they were great. They're not taxable.
Okay. Okay. We are, of course, still seeing ups and downs with unemployment. If someone was out of work last year and received unemployment, what do they need to know about the tax filing and whether there's a tax break in 2021?
Yeah, this one's a little tricky because last year, because of the American Rescue Plan Act, you got a waiver. So you did not have to pay federal tax on up to $10,200 of unemployment benefits. But we have not seen Congress pass a law offering a similar break this year. So if you did not withhold taxes from your unemployment payments, you might owe money or maybe just get a smaller refund this tax season. You're looking for Form 1099-G, and that's going to tell you what you got. And you also have to check your state. Most states actually do levy taxes on unemployment benefits, but check with your state because a handful, about 10, 15, don't actually do that.
All right. And finally, the IRS. We've been hearing for weeks the IRS is underfunded and understaffed. What are we about to get ourselves into here?
A lot of confusion. The IRS has seen budget cuts where they've had a staff reduction of about 17% over the last dozen years. And they say that's amid a 19% increase in workload. Call volumes tripled last year. They were only able to answer 11% of those calls. Hold times, 23 minutes. Let me tell you something. Spend 23 minutes on the IRS.gov website.
Wow.
I bet you will find a lot more information. So the agency cannot help you in the way that you would like to be helped. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, super quick. Might we see delays then getting refunds?
Oh, definitely. There's no doubt. Now, the best way to get that refund is you file electronically, use direct deposit, make sure those child tax credit and stimulus numbers match the IRS notices. If you need human eyes or hands on your file, you will be delayed.
All right. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
The war in Yemen might not get headlines every day, but it's one of the deadliest conflicts in the world right now. And the fighting between the Houthi rebels and a coalition led by Saudi Arabia grew more violent last week. Saudi-led airstrikes in northern Yemen killed at least 70 people and took out the internet across the entire country. The war has created one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. Here and now, security analyst Jim Walsh with the MIT Security Studies Program is here to help us, help provide us with some background on this terrible conflict. And Jim Walsh, good to have you.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
So, Jim, this conflict started in 2014 with the fall of Yemen's longtime dictator. Help us understand the state of the war now and how we got here.
Well, it's persisted and in some ways gotten worse, which is sort of the nature of long-term disputes. Because the longer they go on, if you don't nip them in the bud, then each of the parties finds increasingly devious ways to hurt the other party. And in fact, you referenced the Saudi airstrike that killed people. Also this week, we had a new development, which was Houthis using drones or rockets for the first time ever to attack the country of the United Arab Emirates, UAE, which with Saudi Arabia had been fighting, has been fighting since the beginning in this war. And so now, you know, you have sort of the spread of drones and rockets hitting other countries involved. So that's a bad sign. But what happened was you have lots and lots of parties, lots and lots of different warring factions in Yemen, the long-term dictator dies, and then there's a big fight between the Houthis, who had been fighting that dictator since the 1990s, and Saudi Arabia-backed forces and UAE-backed forces, each vying for control of the country. No one has control of the country, so more and more civilians are dying each year.
And I want to talk about that. Millions of people in Yemen are living under famine due to a lack of basic services and an economy that's in shambles. I'm reading that just in 2021, the UN estimated that more than 370,000 Yemenis died. So give us a sense of just how sprawling this humanitarian crisis is right now.
Well, virtually anyone who ranks the deadliest conflicts in the world, unfortunately, the last couple of years, it's been a consistent top three: Afghanistan, Yemen, and Ethiopia, with that war in Tigray. And in Yemen, it's particularly pernicious. As you say, you know, the sum total of some 377,000 Yemenis have died through this conflict, most of them civilians, and most of those civilians are children. And it just isn't that they've, you know, died incidentally, if you will. Some of them have died in indiscriminate air attacks by Saudi Arabian pilots. Others have been choked off from food and assistance. At one point, the Saudi Arabian government, and it continues to be a problem, blockaded humanitarian aid, UN aid, from coming into Yemen to go to the Yemeni people. So when you do that, the consequences, whether it's the internet, the food supply, medical care, COVID, cholera, it's just piled up one after the other, and it's really the civilian population that's paid the toll. The Saudis don't actually have a bunch of troops in Yemen. The UAE doesn't have a bunch of troops in Yemen. They're fighting the war remotely, but the people who are suffering from this style of warfare are the locals.
Mm. Now, of course, the United States has a role in all of this. And when President Biden took office, he vowed to stop selling weapons to Saudi Arabia in an effort to stop the war in Yemen. But in November, the Biden administration announced a new arms deal with the Saudis. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the national security implications for the U.S. is in this conflict as it continues to escalate?
I mean, even going back to 2015, when the Saudis initiated the war, the U.S. thought it was a bad idea. But they went along with it because there were other foreign policy issues in play. And they thought maybe they could control the Saudis and it would work out. That proved not true. And today, it's sort of the same thing. We say we're going to end this war, but then other issues intervene, and then we sort of back off. And meanwhile, the children keep dying. At some point, the president has to intervene, put his foot down, and get this war frozen, get the aid in, and have diplomacy.
All right. That's Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh bringing us up to date about the terrible war in Yemen. Jim, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Anthony.
In Philadelphia, a number of cultural groups is trying out new ways to present art to the visually impaired. One museum uses printed graphics with textures that visitors can touch. But as Peter Crimmins of member station WHYY found, there is no replacing the power of a vivid description.
The Museum of the American Revolution is introducing tactile graphics in a new exhibition of contemporary paintings of historically accurate Revolutionary War battle scenes. Of course, there was no photography at that time, and the featured artist Don Troiani says the few paintings and drawings that do exist are not very detailed or accurate.
There might be a couple of old woodcuts or a couple of inaccurate old magazine illustrations. And you know, there's no real visual documentation of all these great scenes.
So Troiani relies on deep research of historical documents so he can paint battle scenes with the right details, from who was standing where, to what the weather was like, down to the color of the plumage in the soldiers' hats. It's a lot to take in and a lot to talk about.
We are standing in this painting behind a group of British soldiers. So imagine them in their bright red coats, and there's about 6 inches of snow.
That is Tyler Putnam, the museum's manager of interpretation. He's showing a group of visually impaired visitors a painting of the Boston Massacre, describing the drama of the first shots fired by British soldiers on American colonists.
And so this is a pivotal event because it's the first violence of what we think of as the American Revolution.
One of the visitors is Liz Mayo, blind since birth. She says she's always been prejudiced against visual art. Only recently has she started to appreciate paintings that she can't see.
I'm 44 years old. Okay. The reason I say that is that I am still fascinated at how a painting that's a still painting can represent action. You know, the more description, the better. I'm just like, wow, that's so cool.
She's here to try out the museum's new tactile graphics. These are miniature versions of the painting printed on heavy cardstock. They're embossed with different textures representing various elements of the composition, like snow, flashes of gunpowder, figures, and buildings. Trish Maunder, the director of an organization called Philly Touch Tours, helps Mayu interpret the tactile graphic.
Yeah, so this is all snow, this piece in the foreground here.
Interesting.
So this is foreground, this is middle ground, and the middle ground is where the soldiers are shown.
Wow.
But ultimately, Mayu found the tactile graphics less useful, preferring the verbal descriptions. The tactile graphics are simplified versions of the original paintings. Much of that dense historical detail the artist packed into his paintings had to be stripped out so the textures could be coherent when touched. Another visitor, Simon Bonenfant, also blind since birth, said he liked the graphics that he could touch, but only when accompanied by words.
I think they're really done well. Had a lot of thought that went into them, I can tell that. I say that not to dissuade tactile graphics and tactile drawings, but just to use them as complementary sources.
The Philadelphia Ballet is also trying out new ways to engage people who are visually impaired. It recently offered a live audio description of a dance program called The Spark. The ballet company always offers at least one performance per production with audio descriptions, usually received by the audience member through wireless headphones. But this time, it was played over speakers for the entire audience to hear.
Together, the dancers turn, three turns.
Nicole Sardella describes the movement of the dancers in real time. She says by playing it over the speakers, visually impaired people are less likely to feel isolated from the rest of the audience. Everyone is having the same experience.
Audio description is a service that can benefit everyone.
She also says audio descriptions can help sighted people focus on the dance movements and better appreciate what's happening on stage.
There's so much that goes on. There's so much artistry. There's so much athleticism. There's just so much grace and beauty that can all be captured through words, too.
Back at the Museum of the American Revolution, Trish Monder with Philly Touch Tours also thinks these experiences designed for the visually impaired can benefit everyone and make those experiences richer. For instance, she noticed Liz Mayo and Simon Bonenfant were talking about one of the paintings with their guides for 20 minutes.
When else would you stand this long in front of a painting looking at the details?
Right, yeah.
The tactile graphics are in the trial phase. If the museum can find a way to make the texturized handouts work better, they could be developed into permanently mounted elements in the gallery spaces. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Crimmins.
Okay, are you still recovering from that Bills-Chiefs NFL playoff game last night? Wow. Back and forth, the team scored 25 points in the last 2 minutes of regulation. It is 36-36, and then overtime.
Looking to the end zone for the win! He caught it! Ball game! Chiefs to the championship game!
This is just unfathomable. The Bills had won this game. It was over. Josh Allen with a perfect postseason. And Patrick Mahomes somehow comes out there and shows the world, I'm still here.
All right, let's get the view from Kansas City today. Greg Eklund is a sports columnist with member station KCUR. Greg, okay, did you sleep last night? Did Kansas City sleep?
I didn't get very much sleep last night, Scott, but I think because the metabolism level was pretty high from any fan who attended last night, I would think that other fans didn't sleep very well either.
Yeah, I mean, have you been in social media or in your neighborhood? What is the chatter this morning?
Well, a lot of the chatter is just about the overtime rules themselves, because the Chiefs were victimized by that same rule in the AFC Championship game 4 years ago when the New England Patriots won the game and won the coin toss and had the opportunity to win the game at Arrowhead Stadium, and they did. So there's been a lot of back and forth discussed about that in the last several hours.
Oh, so you mean that the rule where if you win the coin toss in overtime, you get the ball. If you score a touchdown, that's it, right? Game over. So
that's
really,
it's
about the coin toss. Yeah,
it's about the coin toss. And you, as Andy Reid, the Chiefs head coach, even stated today, what is good for the game? He doesn't think it's good for the game when you have a great game that's determined by a coin toss. So yeah, even the Bills, who were victimized last night, and the Chiefs, who had been victimized, I think they're both in support of a rule change on this down the road, because I think they both would feel that it's better for the game if you give both teams an opportunity to win it in overtime.
Okay, to the game now. Some analysts are already calling this one of the best playoff games ever. So the Buffalo Bills are still seeking their first ever Super Bowl win, and they have this ridiculously talented quarterback, Josh Allen. They go ahead with 13 seconds left. And let's take a listen to Kansas City Chiefs coach Andy Reid on what he told his quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, before they took the field with like 3 plays left.
Yeah, when it's grim, be the grim reaper and go get it.
Grim reaper. Of course, Patrick Mahomes gets it. Two lightning quick passes, and they kick a field goal to tie at the end of regulations. Mahomes is already this super duper star in the NFL, but was this perhaps his best performance?
Well, I wouldn't say it was his best performance, but it was his best moment. Not too many quarterbacks in the history of the league could do what Patrick Mahomes did in the final 13 seconds with so much on the line of last night's football games. And yet he pulled it off with 13 seconds, got the Chiefs in a position for that game-tying field goal that forced the overtime, which then Again, by the coin toss, the Chiefs had the opportunity then with the possession to open the overtime, to win the game. And at that point, you feel, okay, with what he just accomplished with 13 seconds on the clock, in an overtime period, he can certainly do this again.
All right, briefly, I'm going to have you talk about the opposition for a second. The Buffalo Bills built the team pretty much to try to take on the Chiefs, and we've had this classic game. Is this one of the NFL's new big rivalries here?
I think it certainly could be, and part of that is because Sean McDermott used to be an assistant coach under the Chiefs head coach, Andy Reid, so the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree in this situation, and he's building a team that, first of all, starts with the quarterback, and they have what is now, that everybody sees, a dynamic quarterback who is capable, under any situation, to pull off a victory. He showed it when he scored the touchdown in the end of regulation with the in the final minute, with his fourth touchdown pass of the night to Gabriel Davis. And he has shown his ability not just to throw the ball, but to run with the ball. So with somebody who is multi-talented as Josh Allen, it all starts there, and the team can be built around an individual like that.
Yeah, and Greg, real quick, the other game from yesterday, Tom Brady, the Tampa Bay Bucks, may have played his last game ever. The Bucks lost to the LA Rams in another thriller by three. Was that another playoff classic, you think?
I think so, especially since on the other side of the ball, you had Matthew Stafford, who has never been in that moment, and it was up to him to establish that moment for himself with a season on the line. He did that in the final minute of that game against the Rams, and with the greatest quarterback of all time looking on from the sideline. So it was the Rams who had the ball last, Stafford making the big play, and the Rams are advancing instead of the Bucks.
All right, Greg Eklin of member station KCUR in Kansas City. Greg, thank you.
You're welcome, Scott.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston. It's Here and Now.